This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What happened to the Atkins diet? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Dr. Robert Atkins' book, Diet Revolution, sold 20 million copies in more than 20 languages, spawning an industry based on low-carb foods. But the craze suddenly declined so much that Atkins Nutritionals declared bankruptcy. On To the Point, this day after Thanksgiving, why did public confidence fade so fast in a diet that encouraged indulgence rather than abstinence? Was the low-carb doctrine oversold or misrepresented? What fad will be next in America, where there's big money in the promise of weight reduction that's quick and easy? On Reporter's Notebook later on America's biggest shopping day, two views of Walmart. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with an archived edition of To the Point. The low-carb food fad is fading away so fast that Atkins Nutritional, the company that spawned it, has filed for bankruptcy. On To the Point, this day after Thanksgiving, what happened to a diet that seemed to replace abstinence with indulgence? What fad will be next? On Reporter's Notebook, the world's biggest retailer and political warfare, two very different films about Walmart. First, this news update. American girl dolls embody the best aspects of U.S. history and the most wholesome of American values. For conservative Christians, they have been the antidote to curvaceous and provocative Barbie. But not anymore. It's all about American Girl's sponsorship of a group called Girls Incorporated. Susanna Meadows is senior writer for Newsweek magazine. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What's this all about?
Well, it's a great irony that this toy, this doll, American Girl, which is so beloved by conservative Christian families for the wholesomeness of the dolls, they're now being banned because the company American Girl is giving money to this group, Girls Inc., which on its website states that it is supportive of Roe v. Wade as well as supportive and inclusive of homosexuals.
So $50,000 at least is going from American Girls to Girls, Inc. What's it for?
It was earmarked specifically for math programs, leadership programs. Girls, Inc. is an after-school facility. There are about 1,500 facilities. They're what they used to be called girls' clubs, places where underprivileged girls can go after school and learn various skills. And they learn things like pregnancy prevention. There actually are abstinence programs at Girls Inc. They learn sports. They learn about technology. It's a very sort of, you know, give these girls what they need to succeed kind of thing. And so the money was going toward these rather innocent leadership, math, technology programming.
How is it, or how important is it to Girls Inc. that it supports Roe versus Wade, and is supportive also, as I understand it, of homosexual rights? And is that a major part of Girls Inc.'s program?
Absolutely not. As I said, it's what it's about is teaching these girls some life skills, and it is a vast website. And on that website, there is this one mention of believing in a woman's right to choose, and that comes into play in their pregnancy prevention program. They teach abstinence to girls, younger women, and then once the girls are in their later teens, some can take a course that does talk about different kinds of contraception and options once or if they get pregnant, and I think that's really the only realm where the Roe v. Wade issue comes into play. As far as homosexuality, the website doesn't even talk about gay rights. What the website says is, we believe that if a young woman is questioning her sexuality, she should be in a supportive environment. So it's a pretty tame statement, and the organization has never advocated for any kind of gay rights issue.
We're talking with Susanna Meadows of Newsweek magazine. So you said that the conservative Christians have banned the American Girl dolls. How extensive is this action against them?
It's hard to say what the effect will be. So far, the ban is spreading via email, forwarded email, word of mouth. About a half dozen Christian organizations have posted information about it on their website. But at this point, it's hard to say how many people will actually follow, go through with the ban, and what kind of impact that will have on sales.
What was the reaction at Newsweek when you ran a story about this?
We were flooded with letters. Most of them were outraged that American Girl would be banned for their contribution to Girls Inc. We even got a letter from a 12-year-old girl saying she was disappointed that moms were not letting their daughters buy American Girl dolls, and she made a point of saying that she once took part in Girls Inc. and she called it an awesome program. I actually really enjoyed hearing from a kid. That's the one voice we don't often hear. We hear that their parents are not letting them buy these dolls or not letting them get the dolls, and we don't know how the kids feel about it.
Again, American Girl grosses $379 million a year. It has girls that dolls, rather, that represent different aspects of American culture and history. Does it seem to have been hurt at all so far by this boycott?
So far as I can tell, no. But we also haven't hit the big crunch of shopping for Christmas, so we'll have to see once the season gets underway.
What is American Girl saying about the boycott by some conservative Christians?
They are confused, but they are standing by their contribution to Girls Inc. They did move the information about the contribution to a less obvious place on the website. The company did say that was had nothing to do with the controversy, but the timing was right. So it's no longer out there for everyone to see.
All right. We will see what the impact is, if any, of the boycott. Meantime, thanks very much to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Warren.
Susanna Meadows of Newsweek magazine. In a moment, what happened to the Atkins diet on this archived edition of To the Point?
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with an archived edition of To the Point this day after Thanksgiving. Dr. Robert Atkins was a cardiologist who determined that low-fat foods with high carbohydrates led to obesity. By experimenting on himself and his patients, he found they could lose weight by cutting the carbs and getting protein from meat and other foods full of fat. The Atkins diet became so popular it changed the economics of the food industry. But the low-carb fad has now faded away. And Yelmokas McDermott is a scientist at the USDA Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
There was so much promotion, not just by Dr. Atkins and his company, but others as well, about the virtues of the low-carb diet. Even fast food outlets picking it up and advertising low-carb attractions, if that's the right term. Why do you think it's declined so fast?
Well, if you look back in the history of dieting, we've actually had trends repeating over and over again. So the idea of a trend coming in, hitting hard, and then fading off isn't something new. I guess what the new aspect is the fact that so many people have banked money behind this idea this time.
What do you mean by that? There was a big investment in all of this.
It was an investment. There were companies made from this. There were books to be had and centers to run health centers to run information off of and to process patients. And then restaurants that bought into this idea thinking that would help them market their restaurant as a whole by appealing to this particular trend. But again, It's a trend.
And on the other side of it, some companies had big trouble as a result of all of this, Krispy Kreme donuts being one of them, blaming its decline on the popularity of the low-carb diet.
It's very interesting. So there were companies that were definitely benefited financially from this, and then there were companies that were negatively impacted by this kind of a trend.
What about the diet itself, then? Now, you say they're all subject to this pattern. By saying that, are you suggesting that this one doesn't work any better than any of the others?
Well, the bottom line is when you take in fewer calories than you burn, you're going to lose weight. When you hold the number of calories that you eat balances out with what you exercise off or move off, you're going to hold weight. So any kind of a diet that's going to help you to decrease the number of calories you take in per day is going to result in weight loss. The big questions I say on diets, there actually are three questions I like to ask. Number one, does the diet help you to lose weight? Does it actually work? Number two, is it sustainable? Because we know that short-term weight loss can be had off of many, many diet forms. The question is, can you sustain that diet so that it's not just a yo-yo effect, that you're going to lose that weight that you wanted to lose and then be able to maintain that weight loss over time? Question number three, does it promote health? A jelly bean diet might help you lose weight in the short term. Is that a healthful diet ultimately for cardiovascular disease risk factors and diabetes and cancer risk and other disease processes?
One would hope that everybody would ask those three questions as they are deciding what to eat and what not to eat, but it would appear they don't necessarily do that. What do you think was so appealing about the Atkins diet?
Well, it said the thing that people wanted to hear. You don't have to count calories, that you can eat all the, quote, bad foods, because it emphasized the fact that meats and cheese and fatty foods, which are so flavorful, that you don't have to even worry about those things. And people are looking for that magic word. And if I come up with a diet that is healthful and nutritious and all, and it doesn't have the buzzwords that you like, it's much more interesting for you or easy for you to write me off and say, well, I have either Dr. McDermott's diet or I could go to Dr. Atkins' diet. And whatever sounds more appealing, we're so emotional about food. There's a lot of emotion behind food choices and what we buy into and all.
Was there a certain amount of misrepresentation about the Atkins diet? It's my understanding that Dr. Atkins advocated fruits and vegetables in addition to high-protein sources, including meat and fatty foods, but that not everybody who took the diet heard that part.
Exactly. But if you actually read the protocol for an Atkins diet, it had stages. It had phases that you went through. And the idea of going on a very restrictive carbohydrate diet was meant to be for a very short term. And then you gradually introduced other foods over time. And ultimately, it got to be a diet that was lean meats and chickens and fish and all, but it had a lot of fruits and vegetables. People didn't want to hear that part, so they found the phase that they liked, which sounded appealing, that eat all you want and the meats and the fats and cheeses and all that, and they just stuck with that part.
Anya Melkus McDermott at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Marion Nessel is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She's author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Thank you for being with us today.
Pleasure.
In what way did the food industry, do you think, which you have studied so closely, contribute to A, the Atkins diet and its widespread popularity, and B, misrepresentations about it?
Well, the food industry's job is to sell food, and that's what they're in the business of doing. And their idea, you know, the idea of any food company that's involved in selling food is to sell more and to get people to eat as much as possible, not to eat less. So that as soon as it became clear that this particular version of the Atkins diet was going to be extremely popular, popularized by articles in the New York Times and so forth, companies started making products to cash in on what was obviously an enormous craze. And so companies started making low-carb products or supposedly low-carb products, and that's when you started seeing low-carb bread and low-carb pasta and other kinds of oxymorons that made no sense at all. And some of these were advertised with rather misleading health claims on them or with misleading statements about what these foods were going to do. So they gave the impression that if you ate a low-carb diet, you'd be eating fewer calories. And if you ate fewer calories, you'd be losing weight.
I take it you say that's a misrepresentation. Can you give us some examples of...
Oh, net carbs. The food companies invented the term net carbs, which were carbohydrates that were the ones that counted in foods. I mean, I remember buying some low-carb pasta, which I thought was just hilarious. It had 42 grams of carbohydrate per serving, and only five of those were net, and so those were the five that were supposed to count. And then you said, well, what happened to the other 37? Well, they weren't counting those because those were absorbed less rapidly, but they still had calories.
What about the low-carb Oreo cookies put out by Kraft?
Oh, I love the low-carb Oreo cookies. Now, Kraft was a little bit late getting in on this, and their low-carb cookies only came out this year, well after the peak of the low-carb dieting. And what I particularly like about them is that they got the serving size of the low-carb cookies down to 100 calories per serving instead of the 160 calories per serving that you get in a usual serving of Oreo cookies, regular ones. And they were able to do this quite cleverly. They just changed the serving size from 3 to 2 cookies. So the usual serving size is 3 cookies, 160 calories. They just changed it to 2 cookies at 100 calories. So that works.
That suggests that people are, in fact, susceptible to a kind of manipulation in the interest of, as you said, selling food and getting people to eat as much of it as possible. What about the government? What about labeling? What about the responsibility of the food industry for people's nutrition?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration really doesn't have its Carbohydrate Act together. It was never a problem before, and so they were really quite unprepared for dealing with the low-carbohydrate dieting problem. There's been a lot of pressure on the FDA to do something about sugar labeling, but they've resisted that because it's difficult to tell the difference between added sugars and sugars that are naturally in foods, and there's an enormous pressure from the food industry not to have separate labeling for added sugars. So they're subject to political pressures just like any other government agency, and in particular the FDA is under tremendous pressure from Congress not to regulate food industries too heavily right now.
Why is that?
It's the kind of political era that we're in right now. This is a very anti-regulatory and very business-friendly government, and anything that puts restrictions on food businesses is not something that's very popular with this particular administration.
Marion Nessel at New York University, author of Food Politics. Back to Anne Yelmolkas McDermott. You're with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Does being associated with the government under these political circumstances put you in a difficult position?
Me personally? Yeah. Not at all. I'm a Tufts University employee. But even in our center, I think our emphasis is on the fact of getting down to the basics of what counts, energy in and energy out. If you look at the new CDC website, mypyramid.gov, they've taken the most recent science and come up with guidelines that will help people. And people refer to this as a new pyramid. And in that new pyramid is an emphasis on fruits and vegetables. There's 8 to 10 servings a day. There's an emphasis on dietary variety, in particular within food groups. The idea of moderation and balance is for the first time emphasized in our pyramid. And activity plays a major role. We know that we're a very sedentary nation, and we need to find ways to increase our physical activity every day. And dietary quality. And I don't think there's a scientist out there that's going to argue with those concepts.
So, Marion Nessel, back to you. There's a lot of information available, more and more sophisticated, based on what science is telling us about nutrition. How good a job is the food industry in particular, and the government as well, doing in getting that information out?
Well, the food industry is where most people get their nutrition information. Food companies and beverage companies spend about $36 billion a year in promoting individual products. And that number is so large, it's just incomprehensible to me. But McDonald's alone spends more than $1 billion a year just in the United States, just on media advertising. And a single product like Cheez-Its or Lunchables has a $25 million a year advertising budget just for media, not even all the other things that they're doing. No government agency has anywhere near that kind of money to put into nutrition advising for the public. So the public is enormously confused because they're hearing messages about individual products, and there is no really unified voice coming out of the government telling people what it is that they're supposed to be eating. The new Department of Agriculture pyramid, you have to have a computer to use it. If you don't have a computer, you don't have access to that pyramid. And so that cuts out not only a large segment of the population, but it cuts out the segment of the population that probably needs that advice the most. There has never been an advertising budget coming out of the federal government to tell people in a unified and comprehensive way about diet and activity patterns with anywhere near the kind of money that even the tiniest single food product has on a yearly basis.
Marion Nestle at New York University, again, author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Bob Golden is Executive Vice President at Technomic, which is a Chicago-based food industry consulting firm. Mr. Golden, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
Are the companies deceiving people and misleading them in the advertising that they put out in order, as Marion Nestle put it earlier, to sell more food?
In a word, no. I don't believe there's any deliberate intent to do so. It's not in the best interests of companies to do that. At the same point in time, as Dr. Nestle pointed out, they are in the business of selling products in the most appropriate and creative fashion that they possibly can.
On the other hand, when Oreo cookies just reduces the serving size and says thereby you're reducing your carbs, that's a little bit on one side of the line, isn't it?
Well, again, I think they do provide information on their packages. I think that the whole food labeling is of great confusion to the typical consumer, and serving sizes in calorie count relative to serving sizes is one area of tremendous confusion. But in defense of Kraft, I think they are disclosing that, and there's a little bit of a caveat emptor in some of that situation.
Is there any effort on the food industry's part to get together and speak with one voice, or is it so competitive that that's just out of the question?
Well, I think it's highly competitive. The industry, as Dr. Nestle pointed out, has absolutely no desire to see government regulation or any form of regulation. So they are the best is to self-regulate. There's no real consistent voice because different companies have different perspectives on the seriousness and the appropriate response to health and nutrition.
So they all have their own nutritionists and they all disagree.
Well, I don't know if disagree, but they present the facts and issues differently relative to their view of the world and their portfolio.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, Bob Golden, I'd like to ask you this question. What's going to happen to the companies that have invested so much, as we heard earlier from Anil Mokas McDermott, in the idea of low-carb foods? If that isn't the trend anymore, what's going to be next? We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about America's apparently unending appetite, if that's the right word, for quick-fix diets. We're going to take a break now in this archived edition of To the Point. On Reporter's Notebook, two views of Walmart. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about the extraordinary rise and precipitous collapse of the low-carb food fad popularized by the Atkins diet. Once again, Atkins Nutritional filing for bankruptcy protection. Bob Golden is Executive Vice President at Technomic, a Chicago-based food industry consulting firm. And Mr. Golden, it appears that a year and a half ago, something like 10% of Americans were on the low-carb diet. That's a lot of people. But that has dropped down to in the neighborhood of 2%. 10% or less right now. What about all of these companies that have invested in the low-carb diet and tried to promote it as vigorously as they have? What happens to them now?
Well, many of the companies that jumped on the bandwagon in a real mass market way were very large food companies, Unilever and Kraft as examples, who came out with controlled carb products and are well able to absorb what in essence is a new product failure, but a costly one at that. And, you know, I think there's some lessons to be learned in terms of reading the tea leaves.
Let me go back to Marion Nestle at the Department of Nutrition at New York University. What about the media in all of this? As you indicated, and I believe Anne McDermott indicated as well, there was an enormous amount of publicity about this, the New York Times and all other kinds of media. Was the fad, so-called, merely a blip?
Well, I think it's a blip, and there'll be plenty more blips. But one of the things that made it so important in the media was that there were so many reporters who were on the diet and were losing weight like mad. So many of them wrote stories about their tremendous success in losing weight. And then they don't talk so much now about whether they've gained it back or not. Most of them have. But one of the things about the Atkins diet that made it really popular was that it worked at the beginning and was very, very successful in getting a lot of weight off very quickly and encouraging people to think that this was going to work tremendously well for them.
So we're back to Anne McDermott's three questions. One, does it help lose weight? I take it the answer to that is yes. Two, is it sustainable? Apparently not, if the reporters are any indication. And three, does it promote good health? Marion Nestle, does it promote good health?
Oh, no. I mean, everybody knows you're not supposed to eat huge amounts of fat and saturated fat in the diet, and you need a diet that has lots and lots of fruits and vegetables. And people interpreted the Atkins diet as being one that was mostly meat and dairy-based, particularly high-fat meat and dairy, and that they weren't supposed to eat vegetables. I mean, I sat next to people at dinner parties who wouldn't eat the carrots on their plate because carrots have a little sugar in them. I mean, I just thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen.
So there was a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding, and people presumably then, as you indicated earlier, chose the particular phase of the diet they liked the best apparently didn't get the kind of results they wanted ultimately.
Well, they did get the results they wanted at the beginning and absolutely swore by it. And I knew all kinds of food writers and food reporters who were on it and were just doing splendidly on it, at least for a while.
Let me go back to the point made at the outset by Ann Yelmokas McDermott that there is a repetitive trend in the United States of a diet fadding. We'll get back and hear more from Bob Golden about that as well. But I want to introduce Andrew Buncombe, who's looking at all of this from the standpoint of his job as Washington correspondent for The Independent, which, of course, is a newspaper based in the United Kingdom. Andrew Buncombe, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What conclusions have you drawn about what appears to be the rise and fall of the low-carb diet?
Well, I'm more than happy to let the real experts speak on this, and I think they make a lot of sense. I'm more than happy to believe it's nothing more than a fad. I'm currently taking up Anne's jelly bean diet because it sounds so good. I think that'll work.
Well,
for
it'll
me.
Work for a while.
But what strikes me in the 4 years that I've been living in the U.S. It's just the world of extremes in which we all live in here. I mean, when I sit down and watch TV, I'm always amazed by the television adverts that pop up. From 1 minute, it'll be someone trying to sell me a gym machine, usually Chuck Norris or someone else with his shirt off, selling the perfect body. The next, it's some vast meal called Hungry Man or something, which belittles people who eat quiche and makes gluttony something to be admired. Nowhere amongst any of this is any common sense. I mean, I think most people know that, you know, if you eat a mixed diet, if you look to diets that have historically worked, the Mediterranean diet, for example, fruit and veg and carbohydrates and some proteins, I think people know all this works. So introducing these new kind of stunty ideas just seems to be part of the extremism. You know, but something is clearly out of control. We all know about the obesity in this country, and I should say rapidly on the growth in the UK. The UK is not so far behind, so something clearly needs to be done. I'm very interested in the way in which we just eat so much rubbish, and that we often don't even know it. We were talking earlier about the food labeling, but I'm always amazed, for example, when I'm buying my orange juice or whatever, your fruit drink or whatever, and I see corn syrup in there. And what on earth am I doing eating corn syrup? What role does that have in a product? So I'd say two things. One is, I think, you know, let's try and reintroduce common sense. Let's try and get away from these extremes. Let's try and get away from the perfect six-pack abs. And at the same time, let's get away from these 64-ounce burgers. But also, let's be a bit more transparent about the labels and the names we give things.
I want to ask you about America as a World of Extremes. The Atkins Diet book was translated into 20 languages and sold millions of copies around the world. Is it just Americans that are stuck with this?
Well, dare I say, what America does first, you know, the rest of the world also follows. No, I think the wonderful thing, the wonderful niche selling point of the Atkins diet was that it was the lazy man's diet. It meant you didn't have to give up too much. But it also was very American, wasn't it? It was the diet of indulgence. It meant you could keep the steak. It meant you could keep the burger. It meant you could have the double fried chicken, Philly steak, whatever. These are all icons of American cuisine, I guess. And I think, you know, people were attracted by this idea.
Andrew Buncombe with The Independent, based in the United Kingdom. Back to Bob Golden with Technomic, the industry consulting firm. What about that aspect of the Atkins diet? Perhaps misunderstanding it, but nonetheless emphasizing the indulgence aspect of it, as Marianne Nessel pointed out, and as you agreed, the food industry wants to sell more food, not less. So was this an opportunity then for the food industry that caused many companies, as you put it, to jump on the bandwagon?
No, I think this one, I think the Atkins diet came on with such force so quickly it actually caught almost every food company off guard, and they responded in not necessarily the most strategic, intelligent fashion.
Marianne Nessel, author of Food Politics, is there any way to predict what the next trend, the next blip or a fad, whatever it turns out to be, is going to be?
Well, I'm hoping it's going to be portion size and that people will now start focusing on the amount of calories that you get from larger portions. But I think that nobody can predict the future, but I can guarantee you without question that there will be more fad diets.
Okay, well, that's where we're going to leave it. And thank you all very much for being with us. Marianne Nessel at New York University, author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Thanks to Ann Ilmokas-McDermott at the USDA Nutrition Research Center at Tufts, Bob Golden with Technomic, the Chicago-based food industry consulting firm, and Andrew Buncombe, the Washington correspondent for the British paper The Independent. Discounts to low-income customers have made Walmart the world's biggest retailer. Now Walmart wants to build huge new superstores and attract a more affluent customer base. In a moment, we'll hear about two films that show two different pictures of Walmart's impact on urban neighborhoods, smaller competitors, and its own workers on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Veterans of last year's Bush and Kerry campaigns have moved into the headquarters of Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas. This time they're campaigning together against Walmart Watch and Wake Up Walmart. Those are public relations groups financed by unions that haven't been able to organize Walmart workers. Robert Berner covers retail for Business Week magazine. Robert, good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
This is pretty unusual, is it not, for this kind of public relations and political campaign to be going on between a corporation and unions?
Probably not when you consider what's at stake for the unions as well as for the company. You know, for the company, low wages are, you know, integral to its business model. To the unions, particularly the food workers union, where, you know, Walmart has been putting a lot of competitive pressure on the traditional supermarket industry, those are high-wage jobs for those unions that, you know, could be lost.
So, in other words, then, this is a major event for both Walmart and the unions involved. What about the economy? Is this a sign of something bigger than even Walmart?
I would say it is. I mean, you have to ask why the Walmart issue has gotten so much publicity. And I think one reason is it ties into insecurity of a lot of workers, you know, with a lot of offshoring of jobs and where everybody's, you know, facing the possibility of a lower paycheck.
We've been talking with Robert Berner, correspondent for Businessweek magazine, covering the retail sector. Robert Greenwald is producer and director of a new documentary film called Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. Robert Greenwald, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Tell us a bit about your film. What's in it that has caused Walmart to respond in the manner that it has?
Well, it's a kind of ironic because they've not seen the film. I've offered 17 different ways to show it to Lee Scott and his folks, to fly down there, to pay for a screening, and all they do is turn me down and then call me names, which is kind of surprising. I thought that they would, given all these high-paid consultants they have in the war room, that I thought that they would do a whole lot better than that.
What kind of names have they called you?
Oh, the most fun was they put out a 10-page statement with, they pulled old bad reviews of mine from 8, 10, 15, 20 years ago for movies that have, as far as I know, very little to do with the Walmart movie. And then they called me a propagandist. And again, all of this, A, is without seeing the film, and B, I asked Lee Scott to be in the movie twice.
Lee Scott is? Oh, sorry,
the CEO of Walmart.
All right.
And I asked him to be in the movie two different times. I said we would put his full statement up on the website. So first, he refuses to be in the movie, and then they turn around and call a film that they haven't seen propaganda and other unpleasant names.
Well, what's in it that Walmart would object to?
Well, what's in it is seven or eight. Well, I don't know what they would object to because, again, they haven't seen it. But what's in it is very personal human stories. It's not talking heads. It's not experts. It's not pundits. It's very real people who are affected by policy. And you see, you know, workers at Walmart, family business owners, someone who works in a sweatshop in China, three managers who I think are really give a very strong indictment to Walmart. Between them, they have 46, 47 years. And they make it clear it's not a rotten apple theory at all, that this is systemic practices built into this corporation. And I think that, plus the fact that we're going to be seen in thousands of churches and schools and homes around the country, has them very nervous. But the solution is not to shoot the messenger. I would have hoped the solution would be to look at what's there and say, yeah, we got to improve.
What do you mean by systemic practices?
I mean that it's in the Walmart in general, whenever they're accused of things, their general response is, oh, well, there's always a bad person, whether it's gender discrimination or racial discrimination or forced overtime or child labor or undocumented workers, you know, the numerous areas that they're being sued in. But what the film does, it makes it clear the managers say, oh, yeah, we were told to go in on a Saturday and how you would cheat workers out of overtime, how you would cross it off their time card. We have, you know, a series of those kinds of stories. A manager, Weldon Nicholson, talks about driving down the main streets of small towns America and pointing out family businesses that they were going to drive out. So those are not an accident, and it's very clear that this message gets passed on. We have a manager or several of them talk about how they were encouraged and guided to guide the workers to go get public assistance so that Walmart would not be paying for benefits, but we, the taxpayers, would wind up paying for their benefits.
So with all of this, particularly if you're accusing them of gender discrimination, racial discrimination, forced overtime, child labor, all the other practices that you have listed, you can see why they might not like the movie.
Oh, I definitely can see why they might not like the movie. But I've spent a year of my life studying this, and I didn't expect them to like it, but I didn't expect them to try to assassinate me. I thought that they would look at it and analyze it. And again, when you have something called the war room, of course, then you have to go to arms, right? And you have to try to use the analogy that goes along with the war room rather than any other possible way, because there are other ways one can respond to criticism. And there's, you know, certainly corporations at different times have responded in different ways. But they've decided to hunker down, go after me, and demonize the film. In fact, we've gotten about 10 emails today. They're having meetings in different Walmarts around the country where they're discussing it with the employees and telling them not to take the film seriously.
We're talking to Robert Greenwald, who's producer-director of this new film, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. Are you in any way affiliated with or funded by any of the unions involved that want to organize at Walmart or any other unions?
I'm not funded by any of the unions that of any kind. In fact, if anybody has a big donor for us, we desperately need it because one of our donors pulled out and we're raising money. I am using the film with all kinds of groups, from 1,000 churches to student groups to labor groups to environmental groups. I mean, you name it. Walmart is, sadly for them, an equal opportunity abuser, and, it, you know, they're paying for it now.
Well, when they call you a propagandist, if you take the pejorative out of that term, isn't that what you're doing if you're playing it in the before the kinds of groups that you just listed?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the film speaks to what I discovered over a year of thousands of interviews and an amazing team at Brave New Films. And the theory, by the way, the operative theory of the film always was the tip of the iceberg. In other words, I would find one story, but I would not use it unless I could back it up with many more and ultimately with facts and statistics showing that this is systemic and that it is widespread. So to the degree that it takes and shows and exposes what's going on, I call it a documentary film. I don't know why one would call it propaganda if I was not telling the truth or if it was not rooted in this reality. But it's actually been a very tough year working on this because the stories are, frankly, they're really heartbreaking. And these are the best of America in many ways, people who work hard, who've had family businesses. You know, people just want a little health care for their kid, and the woman says, you have to choose. Do you buy groceries? Do you get health care? This is a corporation with $10 billion in profit left. Year. It's very rough and emotional stuff.
One of the things that is always said about Walmart that is a good thing is that it has brought high-quality products at low prices, as your title suggests, to a lot of people who couldn't have afforded those things otherwise. And the consumers who patronize Walmart think it's great.
Well, some do, but also by their own internal study that was recently released, they've lost 2 to 8% of the customers because of their practices, number one. And number two, the thing the film goes into, and I think really exposes quite powerfully, is that we, the taxpayers, are paying for those low prices. We're subsidizing them in two significant ways. We're subsidizing them in what corporations call externalizing, where they take costs and put it out onto us, which is the food stamps and the Section 8 housing and the health care, which people have been reading about. And this is in virtually every state in the union, and conservative estimates have this at $1.5 to $2 billion. And then there's the other side of the subsidy, which I was totally ignorant of until I got into this, which is small towns and communities all across America where they're paying Walmart, in essence, to come in, whether it's building roads or giving them tax abatements or putting sewage lines in. That's another $1 billion. So absolutely, milk is cheaper there, but we are in turn paying for that out of our tax dollars, and to me, that's corruption.
Robert Greenwald, producer-director of The High Cost of a Low Price about Walmart. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ron Galloway is producer and director of yet another film, Why Walmart Works and Why That Makes Some People Crazy. He's talking to us from a cell phone as he travels in his car. Earlier, we heard Robert Greenwald say that it is systemic practice in Walmart to discriminate by gender, by race, to require forced overtime, child labor at sweatshops in China and other places, drive family businesses out of business, and to encourage workers to go on the public dole because Walmart pays or provides insurance that they can't afford, tells managers to get them to get to publicly financed insurance instead. Does your film address those kinds of issues?
Well, we sure do, and I guess because my memory is so poor, I'll start from the reverse first on encouraging people to get on Medicaid, let's say, as opposed to taking the Walmart health plan. I think what's happened there is, I don't think that's happened at a corporate level. It may have happened on a store level, but what's going on in a larger sense is so many states are raising their Medicaid eligibility requirements to higher income levels that more people are becoming eligible for it. And if Walmart's sets up, let's say there's Walmart's offering you apples on one side of the street for $2 a basket, and the government's offering you apples on the other side of the street for no dollars, whose apples are you going to take? I don't believe corporate has told people to go get on Medicaid. And there's a flip side to this story also. If you consider that the number that's bandied about that Walmart pays in corporate welfare in terms of Medicaid and say building a road to put in a Walmart, is that Walmart costs taxpayers $1.5 billion a year. Well, let's say you accept that number, and I'm not sure I do, but let's go ahead and say you accept it. Walmart pays $22 billion a year in federal income taxes to vendors Walmart supports, I guess, about 3 million jobs in terms of vendors, which generates about $40 billion in federal income taxes. And Walmart stores nationally collect $11 billion in state and local income taxes. So Walmart is a cash cow for the government. And if you look at it on a return on investment basis, let's say you accept that $1.5 billion number, well, that's $1.5 billion for a return of, you know, perhaps $60 or $70 billion. And, I mean, it's not quite like that, but my point is it's a reasonably good investment, and Walmart is paying for this health care one way or another.
According to Robert Greenwald, he's talked to a lot of people whose stories, he says, are really heartbreaking, and they have to do with those other issues that I mentioned before, child labor in sweatshops, forced overtime, racism, gender discrimination, and those kinds of things.
I totally believe that the first three you said I did not look at. The racism issue I just genuinely believe does not exist at Walmart. Walmart is so large that Walmart almost sets the mean, you know, sets the average. And I believe their employment is reflective, racially reflective, of the population as a whole. I have not found any evidence of racism there on a corporate level or a store level at all. The people that I've talked to, I requested to talk to. Walmart didn't give them to me. I would give them a name, and they would clear it with the manager. And the people I've talked to seemed genuinely happy to be there, and seemed to me, if you look at the numbers, I believe this may be a bad number, but around 70% of the people that work at Walmart are females. Women have an opportunity for advancement in Walmart, and women make up the majority of the people that work at Walmart.
You said that you were able to get people through Walmart. Robert Greenwald said he asked Lee Scott, the CEO, to talk to him. Did Lee Scott talk to you?
Oh, no, sir. None of the executives talked to me. I coordinated through the PR department. I said I was a broker for 15 years, so I'm reasonably persistent, and I begged them until I guess they figured they had nothing to lose. They let me film inside the stores. They did not let me film inside the distribution centers, which in the beginning was really where I wanted to film because I was interested at it in a logistical level. But as I did the film more and more, I kind of went from machine to man. And I determined, or at least I feel, is that the reason Walmart works is not the logistics model that drives everything. It's not the executives, and it's not management, but it's the associates at the store level. My film sort of took me from machine to man. And I think, on balance, Walmart does far more good for Americans in general than they do ill.
Let me ask you this. Walmart suggested your name when we told them that we were going to have Robert Greenwald on. We asked them to respond to what he was going to say. Do you feel are you a spokesperson for Walmart? Did you get any money from them or anything more than cooperation?
Not at all. And they, in fact, have put out an AP press release saying that they're not going to carry my film in the stores, and they've made that clear to my distributor also. So rather than they're promoting me in the sense of having somebody out there talking something positive to say, but in terms of money, absolutely not. I'm not being promoted. I'm being demoted.
All right. Ron Galloway, again, talking to us from his car. He's the producer and director of Why Walmart Works and Why That Makes Some People Crazy. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Back to Robert Berner, our first guest, correspondent for Business Week magazine. Do you think, with all the criticism it's getting in the war room and all the rest of it, that Walmart might change its business model?
Well, I explored this in a story a month ago. Part of it is due to the economic pressures they're facing. Their shopper has been squeezed much more by higher energy costs, higher gas prices. Their sales, what you call same-store sales, which is a real benchmark in the industry, have been weak, and while rivals like Target have been much stronger because Target has a overall more affluent shopper. And so Walmart needs to reach out to a more affluent shopper. They do have those shoppers in their what they call super centers, their combination discount and food stores. But the more affluent shopper just shops the food side. They don't cross shop and, you know, buy apparel or home furnishings or consumer electronics. And, you know, shopping food, that's the lowest margin of any business. So Walmart is trying to reach more of those shoppers and to get them to cross shop the store. And this ties into a lot, I believe, their PR efforts, because, you know, they're attacking this on a number of fronts. Not only are they trying to take the unions head on, but they're doing other things like they're trying to create more environmentally friendly stores. They are looking at, you know, revamping their packaging and using their size to make suppliers, you know, use less packaging, which would cut the use of packaging materials, which would be better for the environment. They've overseas, they're stepping up their efforts in, with anti-sweatshop groups, which helps their image. You know, this is a broad strategy Walmart's using here, you know, to improve its image.
All right.
And much of it's aimed at attracting a higher income shopper.
That's all the time we have for this archived edition of To the Point. Once again, Robert Greenwald's film is called Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. Ron Galloway's is Why Walmart Works and Why That Makes Some People Crazy. The producers of To the Point are Jonah King, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, and Sharman Rembaum. Managing producer, Cameron Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.